You're listening to Underground History, a collaboration between Jefferson Public Radio and the Southern Oregon University Laboratory of Anthropology, or SULA. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and each episode we take a deep dive into little-known aspects of history in Oregon and beyond. I recently gave a talk at a conference that explored the mechanisms of erasure in Western history, how some stories are curated or told, others evolve, and some are overwritten altogether. Central to the erasure of Chinese Oregonians specifically has been the collection of what could be described as massacre myths that exist all over the state. I've been told stories of Chinese fishermen being taken out to sea never to return, workers locked in railroad tunnels or gold mines blown up to avoid payment, and more. These details are often vague, but these unsettling stories are prevalent enough that it's made it clear this has become a trope worth exploring. And my guests today have been doing just that. Anna Maria Spagna wrote a book called Pushed, Miners, a Merchant, and Maybe a Massacre, which explores the so-called Shaolin Falls Massacre along the Columbia River. Eric Gleason is one of the archaeologists who's been researching the validity of this story. Eric and Anna Maria, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. Great to be here.
Yeah. So Anna Maria, let's start with you. For you, this story is really rooted in place, and your book is beautifully written, and it comes back again and again to your connection to this place. So I think this is such a critical component to understanding and really seeing the history of the American West. So I wondered if you could speak a little bit about how place led you down the path to this story and then ultimately to this book.
Absolutely. I came to North Central Washington, specifically to the North Cascades and a very small community called Stehekin at the north end of Lake Chelan in my very early adulthood, and I have stayed ever since. So I've lived essentially in this very small community of 30 people in this magnificently beautiful setting for over 30 years. I own property there. I'm active in the community. I've often said that the place came to own me. I own property, but the place came to own me. And over time, I've also come to think, as I say in the book, that if a place comes to own you, then the history does too. And what is this history that surrounds us? I came for natural beauty. I worked for the National Park Service and cared a lot about the non-human elements of our gorgeous region. But over time, I've become more and more interested in the human elements. And I stumbled upon this story, supposedly 300 Chinese miners being pushed off of a cliff in Chelan at the south end of the lake that I live in. And I thought, how can that possibly be true? How can that be a story that I haven't heard? And later it became, how can this possibly be a story that's repeated so often without evidence? And I just became obsessed with it because I feel like it's part of my role as a citizen, as a beloved of this place, as a lover of this place, to hold its history as well.
And you write in your book about three versions of this story over time. And so the first one is 300 people are pushed off this cliff. And so when you first started kind of pulling that thread, it changed a little bit every time. Or where did you first start to be like, wait a minute here, what's really going on with this? And how did that kind of lead to the second story before we get into the third, just the second one?
So almost immediately after I began to see this story repeated, the way that it's repeated is that indigenous people killed a bunch of Chinese miners and pushed them off the cliff into the Columbia River. And it often said 300. Chinese miners. It didn't take much sleuthing to find that number 300 seemed to have been conflated with a 300-foot cliff. There was one newspaper report that came out many years after the event, but which said a 300-foot cliff. So right away, the 300 came into question. And then one thing that I noticed was that how often the way that the story was repeated used the exact same language. So it had to have all come from one source. And as I went back to that and the idea that it was indigenous perpetrators and began asking people questions, very quickly people started saying, well, you know what they say, the oral history of the myth of the story was that white people had committed it, had dressed up as Indians to commit this crime, which is not an unheard of phenomenon in American history, of course. Mm-hmm. But so it was slowly but surely, the written version of it was giving way to this told version of it, and it kept unraveling as I pursued.
And Eric, you've been working up in this area for a long time. So when did you first come across this myth, and what was your first read on the story, coming from like an archaeological background?
Yeah, so it actually wasn't that long ago, maybe about 10 years ago, that I first came upon it, and then read a little bit more on it later on. So, and it's one of those places, you know, a beautiful place along the river. And we usually work further upstream from here, but the stories of the Chinese miners further upstream are a little less dramatic than this event, but they're clearly there, and they're clearly there in large numbers. So that's why this event kind of sparked some interest, is because there's so little written about the Chinese miners in that area, and here was an event that took place with some kind of significance, or allegedly took place with some kind of significance to a large number of the miners.
Yeah, and you know, when I've been thinking about this or hearing these massacre myths, it's often in rural areas that do not have descendant communities of the once large numbers of Chinese Americans working and living in these spaces. And, you know, kind of where I've landed on this, historian Mark Carpenter, who's been on the show before, has written about settler colonial sin eaters, that's the way he's phrased it. And I love that, as this visual, like, mechanism used to create a violent fringe that could be universally vilified and therefore absolve the masses. So you've got, like, in the ones I usually hear, it's the greedy mine owners or railroad bosses are you know, involved in how sad how this all happened. But in this story, the myth is the indigenous people are used as these bad actors. So I wonder what is going on here that made, you know, that created that myth at that time. Either one of you, if you have a thought, hop on.
the thing that makes most sense to me is that the one written account of this massacre appeared in 1892. So the massacre supposedly occurred in 1875. The newspaper account, which came out in the Spokane Spokesman, was in 1892. So 17 years, that's a long time for it not to have been written. 1892 is when the entire region of Chelan and Wenatchee, this particular stretch of the Columbia River, is being aggressively settled, or however you want to phrase that, white settlers are stealing the land quite transparently here from the indigenous people. So it seems to me that there's a sense in which this story could be, forgive me, a twofer, right? It's demonizing the indigenous people. Look how cruel they were to the original immigrants, the Chinese people, and also explaining the disappearance of the Chinese people from the region, right? At sort of a crucial moment in the history.
You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. You can find us online at jeffexchange.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today we are speaking about place, memory, and how we reconcile with the violence of the past. So, you know, you mentioned that this story kind of provides two goals, and it's interesting that the Chinese immigrants are used as pawns for this larger thing, because sometimes, you know, when the story is told about Chinese American history in the West, it can get into real strong victim narrative territory. And not only do we at the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project like to tell a more nuanced and expanded story of that, but also Chinese immigrants were part of the colonial process. So they still are having a different experience than the Native Americans at this time period. So yeah, Eric, do you want to speak a little bit more to that too, how these two different people are put in kind of this conflict, this symbolic conflict in this historical memory of this place?
Right, because the Chinese miners up in the upper Columbia were, you know, some of the first significant people other than non-natives that moved into the area to kind of work and extract the resources there. And most of the mining was done on placer deposits along the Columbia River, out in islands and bars and stuff along the river. And some of these places were also where the Native American villages were. So there was, definitely some conflict between the Native Americans and the Chinese, and also some interactions that were not conflict as well. There's some records of intermarriage between the two, some talk about trading between the two as well. Some of the earliest stores and outposts up there were Chinese operated stores, like the one at Chelan Falls. There were a number more upriver. So it was, the Chinese were, among the first people that, other than indigenous folks, that kind of moved into the region.
Yeah, that is true in a lot of places, which I think is interesting to, again, to get back to this idea of, like, where are they now, which is a big complex story for another time. And I think this story, how these massacre myths find room to kind of grow and settle in, is because there's this absence. And this is one of the ways that people kind of reconcile that absence of this really important early, settler population. I want to get into, I don't want to totally, say all massacres were fake. I don't want to downplay historical violence. A lot of it was very real towards Chinese Americans. And of course, one particularly tragic and substantiated event was on the Snake River, the Hell's Canyon Massacre, which has been proven and written about at length. And so one of the things that, the ways that I've discounted a lot of these myths, and Anna Maria, you talk about other examples in your book as well, is that there's no primary documents, there's no firsthand witness accounts. We just don't really have anything except for this kind of like romanticized rhetoric of this violent event. So, what are the types of things that both of you would have been looking for in the documentary record to kind of be like, oh, maybe there is something going on here, or there was something here, if it wasn't, not just a newspaper article 17 years after the fact or whatever?
I would think that there'd be some records at the National Archives related to the military at that time, because the military was a presence in North Central Washington at that time. There had been a fort built at Lake Chelan in those kind of similar time span as that. And one would think that the military would have made some kind of reference to a significant event like this. And as far as I can tell, there's no correspondence, no record or documentation in the military records.
Yeah, especially if it's 300 people that are murdered. I know for the Hell's Canyon massacre, the company, the mining company based in San Francisco, was notified. That Chinese consulate got involved, on a government level, like you had mentioned with the military. There were documents and people looking into this. Anna Maria, what about you? What kind of things were you expecting you might find if this was true?
Well, the companies, certainly the Chinese companies, mm-hmm. would have been involved in knowing what happened if these were miners who were working for them in that situation. And then even many people have suggested the Chinese government themselves, as you mentioned, the consulate, mm-hmm. if there were 300, Chinese Americans who were killed, they would want to know and they would be involved. So there's nothing on that side. There were also lots of people I talked to who were talking about the remains of these miners, since the bones, the remains would be important in the culture, and the companies themselves, of course, had employees who would go looking for the remains to repatriate them. And there's just no record of that at all, of even the attempt, which would be important. Now, one thing about the companies being involved is that these miners, it was a little bit prior to the era when they were so involved. These were a lot of independent miners. So maybe that wouldn't be the case, but still there would be some larger government interest in the story, and even newspaper interest. It's not as if there weren't newspapers at the time. There was a relatively large one in Walla Walla, the Spokane Spokesman, even the newspapers in Seattle or Portland. It would have been a big event, and there was plenty of communication up and down the river for people to have heard about it. And there's just not.
Yeah, and I have more follow-up questions, but first we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with more Underground History. And we're back. You're listening to Underground History. I'm Chelsea Rose. We're talking about massacres and myth-making in Washington, Oregon, and beyond. So I want to circle back a little bit to what you were saying about people that would have gotten involved and been reported, and just kind of highlight from our work on the Oregon Chinese Diaspora Project. We've tracked Chinese American settlements across the state, even in the most rural corners. And these folks were really part of a transnational, really vibrant network, and their absence, especially if there was 300 of them, would be noticed. But you had mentioned, too, that there's different ways these folks are working together and you know, whether they're a small mining company or tied into larger mining companies. I mean, there's just a lot of, you know, you just couldn't disappear that many people with without more evidence. And the Whitman massacre you mentioned in there, there's survivors that, you know, people could tell this story firsthand. And when I hear when people come to me with some of these massacre myths, they're like, oh, yeah, my buddy said, his dad said, or, you know, it's like four people removed. But with some of these events, these really violent events, there are firsthand accounts that, again, add this other layer of, you know, validity to it. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Well, certainly. I mean, the absence is glaring, right? There would be somebody who would speak of that, to have somebody to tell the story, to bring it on. But that idea of, I heard it from my grandfather, I heard it from my uncle, it was pervasive. When I started looking into this story, it didn't take me but, you know, two layers of people I spoke with before they'd say, oh, I know somebody who's, you know, found bodies floating up with hatchets in their forehead. Like crazy stories about, I heard from so-and-so how this happened. And I'm of two minds about that. One is, of course, that it sounds like myth-making. We know that it is. And also that it does suggest that the violence and the xenophobia was not unreal, that people recognize it even today. It exists and requires acknowledgement. So that was my twofold struggle in putting the book out into the world, is not wanting to be someone who is, you know, portraying these early immigrants as purely victims, but I also did not want to ignore the fact of violence and xenophobia toward the Chinese Americans. And hence, part of the title is the merchant, Ah Chi, who ran the really quite large store and gardens and ferry business there at Chelan Falls, where the Chelan Falls River, the Chelan River comes into the Columbia. He becomes a major figure in the story, you know, quite purposely to show that these were not merely victims. These are not nameless characters in a story.
Yeah, there's other ways to kind of commemorate and acknowledge his history. I'm jumping ahead a little bit. In the book, you talk about Chi Saw and how, I think you said that he is the first person that has a town named after him in Oregon, or a Chinese American person?
In the United States, it's my understanding that Chi Saw, which is a very small town, I hope you can correct me, Chelsea, but everywhere that I looked, they said it was the first and perhaps the only town in the United States named for a Chinese American. Is that possible? That was the rumor I kept hearing. And that is Ah Chi, the merchant owner at Chelan Falls, later was known as Chi Saw, and the town was named after him up in Okanagan County.
Eric, do you know anything about that? If it's the only one, or what? It seems hard to believe, but I don't know. Maybe so.
Yeah. Well, it might just be. And that really, his prominence, you know, when he moved from Chelan Falls to the Okanagan area to kind of set up a new store there, really kind of shows how these merchants were kind of an interconnected part of the whole trade of the region, right? He had the first store there at Chelan Falls and really kind of supplied miners, not just the Chinese miners, but also, you know, early settlers as well. And his store was there in a prominent landmark for the steamboats that ran up and down the river. And, you know, it's well documented archaeologically as well. So,
The store is. So, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Well, and this gets to something that's kind of sad to me that we have come across a lot working in the Kamwa Chung and Company and John Day with the stories of Lung An and Ing Hei, two very influential men in the region. And a lot of the way that their story has been experienced or told or shared is in these victim narratives that really downplay the really significant things that they did. And I think that's kind of the same thing that's sad here. We don't hear about the importance of Chi Saw. People probably living in the community don't know where the name even comes from, probably. But instead, there's this, you know, easily debunked or relatively easily debunked myth that instead kind of negates the accomplishments and the agency of these men and kind of makes them nameless, you know, murder victims instead of like really leaving space to share the stories of what they did do.
Yeah, and not only them and other Chinese Americans, but also it downplays this myth in particular, where the indigenous people are most commonly named as the perpetrators. It downplays the interconnectedness of those communities, which Eric spoke of earlier. When Achi left the Columbia River and went to the Okanagan, he married Susan Lum, an indigenous woman, and they were, you know, well-known community members. They owned a store in Chisa. They had a trading post. They had children. And that kind of alliance, that kind of connection, even before that, it's well-known or relatively well-known in local history that there was a Chelan indigenous man named Wapato John who had a trading post along the Columbia. But it doesn't take much digging around to find out that Wapato John and Achi, though they were competitors, they had trading bed stores on the river, they worked together all the time. They would together take a pack string down to Walla Walla to get supplies once a year and supply both of their stores. So you see these communities working together in ways, again, that are really lost in history.
And I wonder what, you know, those folks would have thought if this myth is printed first in 1892, if they would have, he would have seen it and been like, what? And also I'm curious about if you talked with some of the tribal people in the area and what their take on this is, like how they kind of think about this myth in relating to its accuracy, but also in relating to what it means about, you know, indigenous people as perpetrators of violence or the reality of them in the way that settler colonialism was so violent for them.
Well, this was very interesting part of the research for me because I spoke to two well-known, one will use the term elder for himself, one won't, but they're well-known members of their communities who hold a lot of the knowledge of their communities. One is up in Okanagan, and he was quite proud in a almost tongue-in-cheek way, but not quite. Arnie Marchand would say that his people did perpetrate it. He said, we didn't kill just 300, we killed 700. And I think in doing so, he was just trying to claim the history. He was constantly downplaying my interest in the Chinese in saying, look, we have been here millennia. They were here a short time. They were encroaching on our land. It was sort of his way of saying, stop paying attention to that. And we're going to listen to my stories about our people here, which is a perspective that I honor, of course. Another person associated with the Chelan people here, also well-known and respected, Randy Lewis, he told me the version, he was the most credible source, if there is one, of the version that it was white people who did it, and that he had heard that from his elders, that it was white people dressed up as Indians. And, you know, you can see some purpose in that, in trying to reclaim the innocence of his own people and speak to the white settlers as the villains in this particular story or in this instance. Now, I have no way of knowing if one of those stories is true or not. And so my way of approaching that in the book was to tell both exactly the way they were told to me.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose, and today I'm joined by Anna Maria Spagna and Eric Gleason to discuss massacre myths. So that leads me to think about, so you wrote everything as you were told, you really thought about it and put in as much evidence as you could in context, but has your book, this came out, it's been out a year or two, right? A little bit of time?
2 years exactly.
2 years exactly. 2 years, yeah. Yeah, so I was wondering if it's changed, if you've seen a change in your community about the ways that people think about this story now that you've been, you know, you've written this book, it's gotten out there. Have you seen shifts or people expanding their perspectives?
Well, I haven't in that sense. And I will tell you that I had high hopes that I would become the Gregory Noakes of this story, the reporter yeah. who actually uncovered the true paper, the hidden papers that told the story of the Hell's Canyon Massacre.
Yeah.
That has not occurred, but one thing that that delights me that I'm happy about in terms of this book is that as it's been out and as I've done lots and lots of local presentations, there's a growing knowledge at least that the Chinese were, you know, original immigrants, original non-native immigrants in this settlers, you know, residents, lovers of this place who belonged here and who had businesses. And I really think that 10 or 20 years ago, that kind of knowledge was really not common in our region. And to at least have that become part of the story is important. important to me, as is the fact that there was a local movement towards exclusion as Wenatchee became incorporated as a town. And so I think that's important for people in these towns in rural Washington and Oregon, just to own all parts of that history.
Yeah. Eric, what about you? In the world that you travel in that area, you know, have thoughts changed about this, or has it been recognized more as a myth?
I haven't really noticed that so much, but, you know, I'm a little bit separated from up there these days. But one thing that has really just struck me about these myths is just their strength and endurance. Mm-hmm. Even in the face of evidence against myths, that they still seem to just have that persistence and that endurance.
Yeah. There was a retired journalist that I kept getting emails from about one of the myths up here about a mine that had a bunch of men were put in it and blown up, and there was a metal door locking the mine shaft, and he was, you know, very interested in uncovering the story and getting justice for these miners. And so when he caught me on the phone, I was like, oh, I hate to tell you, it's a myth. But I, to my surprise, he totally was like, oh, I'm so glad. I was really worried this injustice hadn't been told. So that, you know, I was very thankful that he was willing to kind of hear that. And I explained to him a little bit why I thought that. But, you know, there is some endurance to this. And I think, again, it's because it's how people are reconciling this absence of this population that was once so important to these regions, which, of course, is because of the real structural interpersonal violence of the anti-Chinese sentiment and how that ramped up over time. So, you know, I want to think a little bit more about Eric, if you wanted to tell the story more, not that story, the story of the Chinese Americans living in this area, you know, what are the ways that you would go about doing that? Doing some excavation at the store?
Yeah, something like that might be possible. It might be more underwater archaeology because there's been a reservoir built and the store, probably just the outer margins of the archaeological site where the store is exposed above the reservoir. So that might bring in some technical difficulties. But, you know, maybe more archival research to kind of really dig into the records that remain from the Chinese miners that were there. Maybe kind of placer mining records and deeds and things like that could really kind of help latch in. There's a lot of places up there with names associated with the Chinese miners, right? There's two or three different China bars along the stretches of the river between Chelan and the Canadian border. There's, you know, obvious archaeological sites that remain there, big placer mining deposits. You know, a lot of it's been covered by the dams, the reservoirs behind the dams, but there's still a lot that can be learned from the sites that are still above the water.
In Anna Maria, go ahead.
Yeah. In the there is a famous trading post, you know, that is remembered more than Achi's store, for better and mostly for worse. But the ledgers remain in the museum here in Wenatchee, and if you turn the pages of those ledgers, by far the majority of the shoppers of the names are Chinese names. And even as something as simple as that, to have that as a record of how prevalent they were as, you know, people doing business
in the economy.
That era would be really cool to have the museum show those pages, you know, something as simple as that.
Yeah. And I just want to end, we just have a few seconds left, but we didn't really give you a chance to say the third story and kind of how you ended the book. So just in a few sentences, can you just kind of sum up where you landed on? I mean, I think we've already, spoiler alert, we've already kind of said we thought it was fake, but what's your takeaway at the end of your writing, that how that myth came to be and why it sustains? Anna Maria.
It goes back to sort of how I started my remarks, that year, 1892, it would be a very, very useful time to both villainize indigenous people and to explain away the Chinese who are in that moment being pushed, as you say, systematically out. So stories are powerful. And if there's a smidge of truth, take it and exaggerate it. We see it in our own times and see how useful that is in doing that ugly work.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us today. That wraps up this round of Underground History on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm your host, Chelsea Rose. Our show producers are Natalie Golay and Charlie Zimmerman. You can find this episode and many more wherever you get your podcasts.